Sunshine Meets on Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8.
A very good evening. I hope you're well this Sunday night. You're listening to Sunshine Meets on Sunshine 106.8. I'm Andrea Hayes. And tonight I am meeting one of the most successful male ballroom dancers to ever come from Ireland in the last 30 years, having danced in prestigious venues like the Royal Albert Hall. Although at the moment we probably know him as the tough-talking Dancing with the Stars judge who is always keeping the celebrity dancers on their toes. Sunshine Meets Dancing with the Stars judge Brian Redmond. How are you, Brian?
I'm good, Andrea. How are you keeping?
It's great to have you here. We know each other of old.
That's right. It's been a few years now. We won't say how many.
No, but we're going to go back very, very old, and we're going to start because you're originally from Dublin. Can you set up the scene? Tell us where Brian is from and a little bit about the earlier years of Brian.
Yeah, sure. So both my parents are from Dublin, both born and bred and grew up in Dublin. Dad's from Ballyfermot originally, and my mum's from Finglas. But we grew up, our childhood was out in Blanchardstown, a little area out there called Hunstown. And at the time when we moved out there, we would have been maybe 6-7 years of age, and it was the countryside. You know, there was, Cluny didn't exist apart from the little town that was there originally. And, you know, there wasn't even a secondary school in the area. So it was a real small community at the time, despite the fact how it's grown. And childhood was great. We lived in a normal 3-bed semi, and lots of friends out on the road, lots of a normal sort of childhood. And it wasn't really until I was about 11 years of age that I got back involved or was reintroduced to the world of ballroom dancing, because that was actually how my parents had met. And
I want to ask you about that, because I want to know the names of your parents, how they met, because actually they've had a huge impact on you and your life, and they seem like just incredible parents.
Oh, totally. They're the foundation for everything that both I and my brother have been through our own lives. But my father, Thomas, and my mother, Annette, danced socially. Never, they did a little bit of competition here or there, but more socially. And that was how they met. My father's parents also danced socially. So it's been sort of third generation now, as it were. And it was just a simple trip one day. They had some friends that they were going to meet. They needed to drop something off. And, you know, myself and my brother Philip, who's 2 years younger than me, were in the car. And Mam sort of said, listen, we have to pop in here, you know, just be good. No messing. It'll be only 20 minutes in and out. And we went into this world of ballroom dancing, and we were at this competition, and about an hour later, we were actually taken away. And apparently I just simply stood beside a pillar at the edge of the floor watching all the other kids who were competing on the day dancing, and probably a bit unusually, never moved or never caused any trouble. And we got back out to the car, and I said to Mam, you know, how come we were never allowed to dance? And she said, well, obviously it was never a case that you were never allowed, but we just thought it might not be something you were interested in. So cleverly, you know, she made a little deal with us that we could go along, but we had to go for a month. And if after the end of the month that we didn't want to continue, there was no problem, we could stop then. And it sort of never looked back, really.
And whereabouts was that?
That competition was in Parnell Square, I believe. There was a lot of dancing would have went on around the Parnell Square area at the time. There was a lot of dance halls, you know, traditional sort of dance halls up around there. So that was in Parnell Square in Dublin, and that's where it kicked off from.
And did Thomas continue with the dancing as well?
Philip, my brother.
Oh, Philip, sorry.
Yes,
Thomas was your dad.
Thomas was my dad. So Philip, yeah, absolutely continued right the way through. Philip is still involved in dancing today. Philip owns a huge studio, believe it or not, in Hong Kong. I worked a lot in Hong Kong, and you know, over the years, we ended up going backwards and forwards, and he settled in Hong Kong. He's married out there. He has two daughters out there, and he runs a very successful studio business. Teaching and working with all sorts of people, but a lot of people who would be fairly high up in society. The years in Hong Kong were a real eye-opener for me as a guy from, I suppose, a working-class area in Dublin. But he's very happy out in Hong Kong.
So both brothers continued with this dancing. And I have to ask you, because we're talking probably around the 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, we've been talking late 80s, early 90s, yeah.
Was there any slagging went on? Because, you know, dancing for boys, maybe it wasn't the norm.
Oh, it certainly wasn't the norm. And it certainly wouldn't be accepted, is maybe a strange word to use, but it certainly wouldn't be as openly accepted as it is now. But when I look back on it, I don't feel that I ever suffered as a result of the slagging, if you wanted to call it that. And I think that was the double-edged sword that dance sort of gave to me. It gave me a sense of purpose. It gave me a sense of self-confidence. So maybe when there was the slagging going on, I didn't feel it as being, you know, bullying, for example. I can certainly remember the guys from school, you know, taking the mickey and things like that. But it's certainly come full circle, because the interesting thing now is I have all the guys from school constantly messaging me on Facebook, you know, how do we get tickets for the show? How can we come out and see it? So I sort of have a little wry smile to myself every time I get a message from one of them looking to come out and see the show.
And I know that in terms of your own success, you really went from strength to strength, and then Ireland just couldn't offer you enough of what you needed.
Yeah.
And you were brought to London. But talk us through that and the amount of competitions you're winning. Like, you certainly had, and your brother Philip, just this natural ability to dance.
Yeah, I think, you know, I know positivity is maybe not something that people associate with me, but I think that the positivity that I experienced as a younger dancer sort of set me off on that path. You know, first of all, I was maybe fortunate, or for whatever reason, you know, the first few competitions that we took part in, we did quite well. And that positivity sort of fed itself. And one thing I always remember, I think it was my first national championships, and you know, you got the boys wearing the little tail suits and things like that. But because there was a connection from my parents had a lot of old friends who would have been involved. And I can't remember who it was, but I remember distinctly a guy who was a friend of my dad's saying to me at the first national championships, yapping away to dad, and he said, God, Brian looks really good in a tail suit. And to me, thinking back, you know, that was 30 years ago, A, to remember it from that long ago, but I think it was that one positive comment that made me think, as a 12 or 13 year old kid, maybe I'm good at this. And that sort of drove me forward. And mom tells a story about me being sort of 13 years of age. And at the time, you know, all the commuting would have been done on bus. So we were training, believe it or not, our dance teachers were based out in Rathmines. Now, getting from Blanchardstown to Rathmines in the late 80s, early 90s, was a bus into town and a bus out. It was a proper trek. So we would have spent a lot of time together. And she recalls me saying to her at 13 years of age that this was going to be my career. You know, when we've all got, you know, those sort of, you think, ah, yeah, great son, well done, you know, we'll see what happens. And that was it. Until one day I came home from school, I was about 16 or 17, and a little part-time job, and I said to Mam, right, I've booked that trip. And she was like, well, which trip? I said, well, when I finish my leaving, sir, I'm going to London. And again, you know, it sounds like years ago when you say it like this, but, you know, they didn't have online bookings for flights. Mm-hmm. You didn't have that sort of access. And we used to get a weekly newspaper came from the UK called Dance News, and it was all about ballroom dancing. And there was the classified ads in the back, and there was an Australian guy who was advertising a room to share in a house with a load of other dancers. And I went into what was Virgin Megastore at the time, had Use It Travel, the student travel in
I
there.
I remember it.
And my job at the time was part-time, was working in McDonald's on O'Connell Street. So I nipped across to Virgin Megastore and booked a flight to London and came home and you know, rang up the classified ad and booked this room in this house in London and said to Mam, right, in September I'm off. So I finished the leaving cert and worked through the summer, and I had £600 sterling in my back pocket when I flew into Heathrow for the first time on this, what really was an adventure. And it was the first mistake I ever made. First step in the learning curve was when I got off the plane in Heathrow.
What did you do?
I had, you know, Mam bought me, sounds really kish now, but an old school file of fax to keep people's phone numbers in, because it was phone box stuff, you know, and, to, you know, diaries and that. And I had the address written as to where I was staying. Arrived in Heathrow, £600 in my pocket, thought it was loaded, and thought, well, how do I get from Heathrow to this? There's a black cab, that'll do. So by the time I arrived where I was staying, my first £100 was gone. Now, I don't think it was a £95 fare, but I think this guy sort of saw me coming, and it was a very steep learning curve from there.
And a tough time in London, but nonetheless hugely successful. How do you get from arriving there as a young guy with, you know, now £500 in his pocket to the Royal Albert Hall? And how did your career move on from London? Because were you spotted? Were you encouraged? Mm. How did that unfold?
I think there's two reasons why I was, you know, relatively successful during that time. First of all was going back to the upbringing. Both my parents have a huge work ethic, massive. And it's something they've instilled on myself and my brother. They still work in the dad's 67, I think, now. And he's just the only word I could describe him, he's just an animal when it comes to work. Nothing stops the man. And Mam is the same. So we had a good work ethic. And the second thing was necessity. It's, you know, we were always encouraged before I left that, you know, if things don't work out, we're always here, you can always come back. But I think pride was something that drove me on. And, you know, during those years, and, you know, students all over the world have experienced that lack of funds. But it would have been, it was tough. You know, you were trying to do any job that you could get and hold down while still trying to train, because we'd no funding. You know, it's not like being an elite sports person. So we had to self-fund. And it was the combination of having to survive and the instilled work ethic that we had from our parents that just made me knuckle down and keep pushing and keep pushing and keep pushing and keep pushing. And step by step, you just, you know, you improve, you move up the ranks, you develop, and results started to improve. And before I know it, I was then starting to get invitations to travel, to compete, and eventually invitations to travel to teach.
Well, we're going to talk about that, but we are talking to Dancing with the Stars judge Brian Redmond, and as we're seeing, he's a very soft side really underneath it all. Now, you're going to choose your first song because it's your soundtrack tonight, and it's Aha. Tell us why you've chosen this one.
Yeah, I think the reason I've picked that one is when we look back, when I look back at my younger days, I don't think we're formed in the same way we are as adults. So music that, you know, some of the tracks we'll look at later on mean a lot more to me than this Aha piece did. But it was just the first populist group that I was, you know, buying into. Why? Because probably everybody else was buying into it at the time. And it was just a good, fun piece. And when I think back, you know, that was one of the bands that I would have listened to first.
Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8.
You're very welcome back. I hope you're having a nice Sunday evening. You're listening to Sunshine 106.8. It is Andrea Hayes and Sunshine Meets. And tonight we've been chatting to Dancing with the Stars judge Brian Redmond. And Brian, as we were talking about, we've set the scene. You're in London now. You're starting to go up the ranks, but you're talking about being asked to travel now. And suddenly you've been asked to compete, but also teach. So this now is becoming the career that the 13-year-old Brian perhaps
always wanted.
Yeah, so how did that unfold?
Well, it was the usual sort of struggle that every person who gets involved in anything competitively, it's step by step, week after week, day after day, pushing, pushing, pushing and moving up the ranks. Started doing very, very well in sort of the under 21 levels because I was only 17 when I moved to London. It seems really strange now when you think about a 17-year-old moving lock, stock and barrel. At the time, it was a bit of a crossover because we would have traditionally in this country lost so many people to the UK. And when they were gone for many, many years. And now people commute over and back for work, you know, on a weekly basis. And it was that interim thing of we were still there, but we weren't there. So working away and progressing away and training every day, every chance we got, starting to progress, you know, making those, dancing at the Royal Albert Hall, for example, you know, it's just a fantastic, fantastic place. And when anybody who's ever been in the Royal Albert Hall knows that when you walk around the circle, there are pictures of all the iconic events and performances that have ever happened there. And just to be in that environment was really, really special. So there was all these moments throughout my career that just gave me the spur to keep going and to keep going. And, you know, London at the time was a very exciting place. And I was working in central London, so I had the buzz of going up there. Now, I wasn't doing anything very highfalutin. You know, I was working, for years I worked in a sports shop just off Trafalgar Square, which was something I enjoyed, but literally it was just to pay the bills. So there was the excitement for a 17-year, 18-year-old of living in London, the hardship of trying to make ends meet, and that drive to keep improving and to keep developing.
And it's similar because it's the same drive and those step by steps that the competitors need week to week in Dancing with the Stars. And we will talk about that later, but it's interesting your work ethic, and you really require that in the
Absolutely.
In
it's
the
key
Stars.
For everything in life, I think.
Yeah, no, it's so interesting. Now, you mentioned your brother Philip. How did Philip end up in Hong Kong? Because I know you've real close links to you in Hong Kong. You had great success there.
Yeah, well, the Hong Kong story came about, I was about 21 or 22, and it was the first invitation. I'd travelled to compete quite a lot, you know, I'd been invited to the States and we'd compete in Australia and all over Europe. So the invitations to compete had been coming in for a few years now, and it was a great way of seeing the world because, you know, being blunt about it, they were paying for you to go. You know, you didn't get that much time there. You know, they weren't going to pay for you to have 5 days floating around, you know, but it was, you'd still been there. You could tick them off your list. And the invitation to go to Hong Kong was to go and work in a studio for Hong Kong. It was a short-term contract. It was 6 weeks at the time, obviously, and initially to start off with. And that was amazing because, again, we were still at that stage where money was really, really tight. And I remember a very good friend of mine who sadly passed away a few years later from a brain tumour, Scott, was on the same contract. And Scott had gone a week before me. And I remember I had enough money for the flight to Hong Kong. And the studio were then going to reimburse those expenses when you got there. So I rang Scott and I said, listen, what's the best way to get from the airport to the hotel? And he said, well, you can get the train in, or he said, it's about £18. He said, there's a bus that goes, that's four. And I said, right, it's the bus. You know. So I remember arriving in Hong Kong and that little few quid in my pocket to get me through the first day or so, and started working in that studio. And it was a totally new world because the studio that we were working in dealt with very successful business people in Hong Kong. So here were myself and Scott, who was from London, hadn't got two pennies to rub together. And I just full of surreal, surreal moments. That's the only way to describe it. There was three brothers who loved to dance. And they danced. It was their passion. It was their mindfulness. It was their opportunity to get away from the high business world they were involved in. And I checked them out one day. You know, I was going into Hong Kong airport and Forbes Rich List magazine was there. So I picked up the magazine. And I thought, there they are.
They weren't that wealthy.
$5.2 billion between the three of them.
And you were teaching them?
And we were teaching them.
How to dance.
Yeah, how to dance. Another lady that I teach, a very good friend of mine actually, said to us one day, she said, would you like to go out for dinner this evening? And I said, yeah, that'd be quite nice. You know, so she, there's a few of us going, you know, there was her and her husband and a few of the other dancers. And I said, where are we going? She said, there's a thing in Hong Kong, people won't know about it, called the Noonday Gun. And it's on the dock wall, I suppose you'd call it, in Hong Kong, down in Causeway Bay. And she said, I'll meet you at the Noonday Gun at 6 o'clock this evening. So I'm standing there. And this little guy comes running up to me in a pair of little white shorts, white plimsolls and a white short sleeves. He said, Mr. Redmond, Mrs. Ting is waiting for you on the boat. And herself and her husband had this yacht that was 67 feet long, 4 bedrooms, 3 permanent staff on it. And we were having dinner on the boat.
On her yacht.
On her yacht in Hong Kong. And I barely had the bus fare to get into Hong Kong in the first place. So it was, and they were lovely people. You know, they were lovely people in one sense. While their wealth was quite clear to see, they didn't treat you any differently because you weren't in that category. So,
but you were the experts as well.
Absolutely. And it was an interesting, you know, psychologically it was interesting because you had these people, it's a bit like Dancing with the Stars now, who in their normal life had nobody who told them what to do. They were the big bosses, both boys and girls, men and women. And for 1 hour a day or a couple of hours a week, they'd come into a dance studio and have some guy from Europe telling them they weren't very good at this and they weren't very good at that. And I think it sort of kept them grounded as well.
Well, what's interesting, Brian, is we know that you are very honest and you do require perfection. So I'm sure they really admired your level of attention to detail.
That was something that was, I think, key for them. They had, I learned, I suppose, so much because I think regardless of where you are in life, whether you're just starting off or whether you're very successful, I think those traits are the same. And I've always admired successful people, not because of what they have, but because of how they've achieved it. I don't get caught up in, you know, the celebrity thing. But when I come across successful people, you know, we had, you know, for example, Nora Casey on the show last year, hugely successful. When I got the odd opportunity to speak with Nora, What I was interested to hear and admire was her story, her journey, her struggles, because that's something that allows anybody who's coming along to sort of have the energy to keep going in terms of the struggle for themselves. So that was what I learned in Hong Kong, that no matter where you are, we all face the same problems. They're just on a different scale.
Absolutely. They can be small money or big money.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter. Now, how do we get from Hong Kong to you becoming a businessman yourself? Because what people probably don't know about you, as well as being, you know, one of the most successful ballroom dancers in Ireland, you're a very successful businessman. And was it sometime in Hong Kong or in London that you decided, actually, I'll set up my own business?
There was two sides to that coin. The first one was when I actually started travelling a lot to Hong Kong. I used to go for 6 or 8 week trips at a time, and I could be, you know, they used to ask me to go over maybe 4 or 5 times a year. So I was spending a lot of time in Hong Kong, and I was still traveling for competing, and we were still renting a small little apartment in London. And again, my parents, this is probably about 15 years later now, so we're up to sort of the 2000s. And my parents had said to me, that's nuts. I'd spent 4 weeks in London in 1 year. And so they said, but Ryanair, so Michael O'Leary is probably the reason that I'm back here in Ireland, because the difference between that and 15 years earlier, it was now easier and more affordable to travel from Ireland. When I wasn't in Asia, I then started basing myself in Ireland. And the key for me was that young up and coming dancers in Ireland were now asking me to do a bit of work with them. And I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed sort of the not the dependence, because it wasn't an ego thing, but the fact that I had to leave home when I was 17 to develop myself. And I felt I had something to offer these younger dancers that meant that they wouldn't have to go through that same hardship. So I started working with young dancers here. And then from there, spent less and less time traveling. My brother spent more and more time out in Hong Kong. I spent less and less time out in Hong Kong. And eventually, you know, a few years later, I thought, well, I felt I'd reached as far as I was going to be able to reach competitively. I was tired of traveling. It's been 10 years really on the road. So I spent more and more time here and started teaching more and more, and had been lucky because 15 years I'd been working in professional dance studios. And now I was back to the school halls and the church halls and all that type of thing. And that was when I decided that, you know, I wanted to try and develop a space that dancers, I suppose, could call home here in Dublin.
Which is an incredible story in itself. We're going to talk more about that. But I must ask you, is that where you met your wife, Jennifer? Was it in when you came back to Dublin, or was it in London times?
No, I met Jennifer here in Dublin. There's sort of two parts to our meeting. The first was Jennifer used to dance and compete when she was a child. Now, she stopped when she was sort of 15 or 16. So she enjoyed it, loved it, still loves dance. But for her, it was a hobby. You know, it was different. And I'm 5 years older than Jen. So when I was sort of 16 and 17, she was 11 or 12. And without getting into it in too much detail, if you're a 15 or 16 year old boy, you're not looking at the 11 or 12 year old girls. You're looking at the 16 and 17 year old girls. So Jen remembers me competing. It sounds cocky to say this, but I don't remember Jen.
And we're going to find out how you and Jennifer, or Jen, and I know Jen as well, met. But we're going to bring you back to London for the next song choice, yeah. Because it's quite a poignant moment and you might set the scene. You've chosen a particular song for our next song.
Well, the song I've picked is Candle in the Wind by Elton John. And there was two reasons why I picked it. One, because lyrically, you know, I'm not Marilyn Monroe, for example, but there was a lot of connotations in the song in terms of trying to be or being something that you weren't. And while I was I always tried to be myself, the Brian that was living in London was a Brian that was developing and changing and growing up. And I felt that that was a different Brian to the Brian, the child that had been here in Dublin. So there was that element to it. But of course, during those years, we also had the passing of Princess Diana. And that song was synonymous with that event, huge event in British culture. And I was working in Trafalgar Square in London at the time. She passed away on a Saturday night into a Sunday morning. We were actually supposed to be going to a competition down in Bournemouth, I believe it was, on the Sunday morning. And the event was cancelled. There was no logical reason for the cancellation of the event, but it just summed up how the nation felt about it. And the only way I can describe how London felt for those 2 weeks was, last year we had the snow here. If you were in Dublin city centre when we had that really heavy snow, everything felt quiet. There was an eerie nature to the city here. And this was the middle of the summer in London. The place should have been buzzing, but everything was quiet. And I remember walking down the mall. I used to be able to get the tube home, but a few days that week I would walk down the mall up to Buckingham Palace to go around to Victoria Station. And to see so many people gathered in one place so quietly was eerie. And this song just not only summed up that period in British history, but as I said, described how I felt during those years in London.
Goodbye, England's rose. May you ever grow in our hearts. You were the grace that placed itself where lives were torn apart.
Sunshine Meets on Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8.
You're very welcome back. We're into our final part of Sunshine Meets. You're listening to Sunshine 106.8. It's Andrea Hayes. And tonight we're talking to Dancing with the Stars judge Brian Redmond. Now, Brian, we've kind of spoken about your business here in Dublin, and it's doing really, really well, actually in Kildare as well.
That's right, yeah, Kildare Town. So we've Spin Activity Centre down there. And it's amazing how things have diversified, because it started off just doing dance classes, and then we moved into this building in Kildare about 2.5 years ago, and it was an old Jackie Skelly's building. So there's a swimming pool there. So we've 250 kids a week doing swimming lessons in it. And obviously I don't teach the swimming lessons, you know, we've a very qualified team of swimming coaches to do that. But it's great. And I think it's a family owned, family run business, and it's aimed at families, a very family friendly environment.
Now, I'm going to bring you back to about 8 or 9 years ago when I met you, yeah. And Strictly had become the big, you know, draw that it is, similar to Dancing with the Stars. And you were asked to be a judge on a celebrity Dancing with the Stars.
That's right, yes.
I was emceeing with John from the FAI.
That's right, yeah.
And you were quite strict on the celebrity people back then.
Yes.
And I remember saying to you, because I was doing my animal work on TV, I said, you know what, if ever there was a Dancing with the Star, or Strictly Come Dancing in Ireland, it wasn't Dancing with the Stars, you'd be a great judge. And you gave me a little kind of wink and you said, watch that space. Now, little did I know behind the scenes, Larry Bass, Sunshine has met Larry, and I know Larry of old from Shinawil, but there was stuff already happening.
There was. In fairness, Larry is great at what he does. You know, Shinawil have produced some fabulous formats down through the years here in Ireland. Dragon's Den, for example, another absolute juggernaut of a show that was one of theirs. And it was about 10 years ago when Larry shot the first pilot for a dancing show here in Ireland. And again, they were, you know, scouring the dance scene here in Ireland for people to be involved. And they approached me and they asked me, would I be interested in being involved? And I said, yeah, for sure. Absolutely delighted to. But they wanted me to dance on the pilot, be one of the pro dancers. And thinking back now, I'm quite pleased that they did, because it shows that, you know, 10 years ago, they still thought I was young enough to do it, but it's different now. But even then I was like, no, I want to be a judge. I want to be one of the judges. And they were like, no, we've got that judging lineup sorted out for the pilot show. So I danced on the pilot of it. And then, you know, at the time, for whatever reason, the TV companies, RTE and that, weren't ready, I think, for that show at the time. So when it came back around then, you know, 3 years ago now, I was delighted to be asked to be involved. Still had to go through the same audition process that everybody else went through, but was just delighted to be asked.
But you know all of the judges.
I do, yeah. I'm quite lucky, because out of the three of us, I was the one who knew the other two. They had never met previously to that. So I've known Lorraine, because she's from our ballroom dancing world. I've known Lorraine 30 years. And since being back here in Dublin and being involved in dance in general, you know, Julian, sort of iconic, if you like, on the dance scene, as it were, here in Ireland. So I got to meet Julian then about 8 years ago. So I was lucky that I knew both the guys before we started.
And interestingly, as a judge, you're kind of considered the tough judge or Mr. Nasty occasionally. But actually, you've not changed, because you were quite strict. You're just very passionate. And were you ever encouraged to change, or, you know, being on TV, maybe somebody says to you, God, you might be liked more if you were a bit nicer, or, you know, how has being on TV changed you?
Well, I'd like to think it hasn't changed me at all. That's the key thing for me. And it's great to be on TV. But it's great to be on TV not because it feeds my ego. It's great to be on TV because of the opportunity that it presents. And when I say that, I mean the simple things. I've met so many people by being involved in the show. Everybody from the sound guys, the carpenters, the hair and makeup girls out on the studio, they're all new friends that I've developed. You've got opportunities like this to come in and talk. Like, who gets a chance to talk about their life on radio? And you're bringing the kids out to the set and that little bit of magic that it brings. So for me, that's the real benefit of being involved in the show, that when I am on my deathbed somewhere and the kids are looking back, they'll remember those days and those times, because they will go. I'm no doubt about it that, you know, Dancing with the Stars, I believe, will run for quite a few years yet. But I'm not going to be on it when I'm 75 or 80. I couldn't imagine that being the case. So even if it runs for that long, it'll be somebody else, not me. And I'm okay with that. That doesn't mean anything to me.
Now, speaking about somebody that left Strictly Come Dancing,
yeah.
Len.
Yes.
You were asked to go over an audition.
Yeah.
There's somebody who was part of the, you know, the whole format.
Absolute icon. Yeah.
And he left you. An absolute icon. Tell us about getting that phone call, because that's quite an overwhelming feeling to think that the UK format is looking at Brian.
That was a surreal morning. And it couldn't have come at a worse time, really. And I'll explain why. Because we were only in our first season of Dancing with the Stars. So it was all very new, and there was still a lot of pressure in terms of, you know, live TV and everything that goes along with that. And it was the Sunday morning of the very first final. And I went into the canteen area where Catherine is out in studio, and I was making a coffee. I didn't think there was anybody around. And I heard this shout from across the room, "Brian." And I turned around, and it was Larry Bass, who we've mentioned before, from Shin O' Will. And he gestured to come over. So I went over and sat beside him. He said, "I'm after getting an email this morning from the BBC. And, you know, at that stage, you're thinking, well, where's this going? And he said, obviously, you know, Len is retiring. And they're going to have to recast one of the judges. And he said, they've sent an email asking, would you be interested in going over and doing a screen test? So at that stage, you're thinking, my God, you know, this is a huge opportunity. Even for the experience, even to be asked, even at that stage, if it never went any further than that, the fact that they'd considered asking was a huge compliment. And they screen tested, I believe, 7 people. So it wasn't a massive list. It was quite a tight little shortlist. A lot of them were from the British format, and the two that they'd invited over outside of the British format were myself and Lorraine. Now, I didn't know they'd asked Lorraine, and Lorraine didn't know that I'd been asked, because it was a bit ridiculous, actually. They had code names for us all. They had code names for all the different people.
What was your code name?
There was numbers. So I was number 4, I think I was. So the funny thing was, on the morning that we were brought over, flew into the UK, they'd sent a driver to pick us up from the airport and everything else. And we arrived at the studio and pulled up at the studio, and there was 2 front doors into the studio. And I simply asked the driver, which front door was it? And as he was about to reply, one of the production assistants came out, and the driver replied to me by saying, well, Karen Hardy, who was one of the other people screen testing from Strictly, a lot of people would know her, went in that door there. And the look on the production assistant's face was just, oh,
You've given away one of the other names.
So obviously Shirley Ballas, who's been cast now in that role, was one of the others, myself, Lorraine. And it was great, because went over, really enjoyed the experience, had the whole Strictly set. Craig Greville Horwood was there with us to get that bit of banter going. And Louise Rainbow, who's the series producer on the BBC, had said afterwards, listen, great job. It'll be a couple of months before you hear anything. And then the phone rang a week later, and it was the UK. And I thought, whoa, this is Louise Rainbow. That's quick. Now, she rang to say the Sun newspaper had been onto them that morning and asked them to confirm or deny 7 names, which obviously they didn't. But she said to me, I'm just letting you know, the 7 names they have are the right 7 names. So your name is going to be mentioned and everybody will know about it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, I just can't, like, even being in everybody's television on a Sunday night and being so infamous and famous as you are now. And it is incredible that it hasn't changed you, Jen, or the 2 kids, because you're the same person I met all those years ago.
Because all of these experiences are about the family, and that comes from my parents again. So it's about opportunity for the kids. You know, even you want to be blunt about it and talk about it financially. With the greatest respect, what we do here in Ireland is not going to be life-changing from a financial point of view. Now, maybe the Strictly job might have been, but it's not going to be life-changing. And when, you know, Larry asked me about that opportunity in the UK and whether I would do it, and in fairness to Larry, he was quite candid. He said, you know, this, should it happen, would change your family, could change the family dynamic in terms of having to travel, having to be away. It's a big thing. And the way I explained it to Larry is I said, everything that I do is about trying to make things better for my kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Larry, I don't care about being famous.
Mm.
I said, if somebody offers me the sort of money they were talking about for the Strictly contract to sweep the streets, I would have done it.
It's hilarious. I could imagine it as well. Now, we have to very quickly talk about Dancing with the Stars.
Of course.
Because it is on TV. Everybody's going to be watching it tonight. I can't ask who your favourites are because I know you will never tell me anyway. But are you excited when you see the stars progress? Because there's been great progression already in this series.
Yeah, I'm excited for the show and I'm excited for the viewers at home, but I'm most excited for them because they are putting themselves out there, first of all, for, let's call it public ridicule, I suppose, a very strong way of saying it. But apart from the flack that they have to take from the judges sometimes, you know, you're always going to get that social media stuff of so-and-so's not great and, you know, all these armchair experts at home putting it. So they put a lot of hard work in. And for them, I love to see the progression because, again, going back to my time in London, if you put the hard work in, I believe you will always be better. You may never go on to become a world champion, but if it's something that you're passionate about, you can definitely be better tomorrow than you are today.
And that's a great even phrase. And the thing that I find quite interesting is that it's really got the whole nation dancing again. There's people going out dancing that never danced and maybe doing it as a hobby, which is lovely.
Yeah, I teach, and people often would contact me and say, for example, do you teach beginners? And my answer to that is absolutely yes. First of all, I'll teach anybody who is genuinely willing to learn.
And give us the name of your teaching place just so we get it in.
Yeah, so Spin Activity Centre down in Newbridge would be where I'm based Monday to Friday. Also coaching a competitive club down in Wicklow, which is in Rathnew, Wicklow Latin and Dance. So they're the two locations that I teach in. Spin is the main base in Kildare. So anybody around the Newbridge area who's lucky enough to be on our doorstep and wants to pop in. But we do, you know, I've absolute beginner in years of age. I have competitors down there who I teach. And about 6 months ago, and I think this sums up the situation in terms of people being connected to dance brilliantly, a lady came to me who was, she wouldn't mind me saying, because she's quite humble about it, in her early 70s. And, you know, she wanted to dance. She had never had the opportunity when she was younger. And as a teenager, she used to work in one of the chip shops at the weekend to help keep things. And she used to always look longingly at the other teenage girls coming in from the dances and the discos, and she started dancing there in her 70s. Very fit, great, great, great woman. You'd love her. Her outlook on life is phenomenal. Still runs 5K a day across the Curragh, so she's a great, great woman. And she comes in and does some of the adults beginner classes and absolutely loves it. So again, it's a bit like I said earlier on about the opportunity that Dancing with the Stars presents to me. Teaching just presents me the opportunity to meet people, and that's what I love probably more than anything else.
And that's what lights you up. But I will warn you guys, if you go to see Brian Redden, Redmond, he will be strict, he will be tough.
Yeah, we have a bit of fun in the classes, but again,
you always have fun and positivity.
There's a bit of a masochist, I think, in most Irish people. They like a bit of stick, I think, in general.
Well, you like people to progress, and I think, as you said, you like hard work, and it's paid off so well for you. Now, we've sort of chosen this song for you. It's not one of your chosen songs, and it's kind of just a nod to the show, but Sunshine has just met the most incredible man. He is, of course, the judge on Dancing with the Stars, but you can get him if you want down in his own business in Newbridge, and it's called
Spin Activity Centre,
and
it's spinactivitycentre.ie.
Sunshine has just met Brian Redmond. Enjoy and keep dancing.